and welcome to week 7 of Megillat Ruth. I hope it has the source sheets. They were sent out middle of the day on Sunday. We're good. Okay. So it's become crystal clear at this point that we're not finishing before Shavuot, which I think is good, in the same way that it was good that we needed a week after Purim to learn Megillat Esther, because, you know, the Megillah is not for the sake of the holiday. This is Torah all year long. So we are going to demonstrate that by continuing to learn Ruth after Shavuot. But what I really hope to do today, is to make a lot of headway on chapter 2, and then next week probably to wrap chapter 2 and see some key elements in chapter 3. So we will have seen, quite a bit by the time, we get to Shavuot, and then we'll have another, you know, week or two after Shavuot to wrap up Ruth before we get whatever we can about Megillat Echa. If I have to choose where I want to spend more time, it's going to be on Ruth than on Echa. Okay. The source sheet should say at the top, Ruth week 7, who is Boaz, the reality of gleaning.
That's... You teased me a whole lot about finishing on time.
Okay. So last time we started the conversation about Perek Bet, about the second chapter, by asking, first of all, what they were doing for support until Ruth decided to go gleaning, and we had the Medrash in Ruth Zuta that said that Naomi was working, and it would be bad for Ruth to actually go out there and start working, and that was something that certainly made sense in the period of the Shoftim. We talked about what she might have been working on, what did they still have their field, versus the Malbim. And the Malbim says that Naomi wasn't actually doing anything to this point. I saw that there was a blip there in the internet connection. I just want to switch networks here briefly, and hopefully it won't disrupt anything, and then I'll be better connected. Okay. Everyone good? You can hear me? Okay, I think this will work better. All right, so we started the conversation last time about who is Boaz. The standard view, well-founded in the text, is that Boaz is wonderful. We noted that he's introduced as Ish Gibor Chayil, a term I want to come back to in Chapter 3, when we see that Ruth is an Eshet Chayil. Dr. Yael Ziegler pointed out that his opening words are to invoke God's name, Hashem Imachem, God is with you. And that in and of itself tells us a lot about him. And what I want to do is pick up from there. As I noted, by the way, in the email, I'd like to dedicate learning for today. Our series is dedicated by Dana and Ilan Rubinstein, but I want to in particular dedicate learning today in memory of those who died in Meron, as well as for Refuah Shlema, for the survivors of it. I will note for you, our Beit Midrash is planning a Tanakh initiative over Shavuot in memory of those who died in Meron. More information to come as it's available. Okay, so if you look at Boaz's actions in the story, and Susan, I know from your email your view on it, but just generally speaking, his actions in the story, we can certainly defend the view that Boaz is wonderful. He helps and protects Ruth. He is presented in contrast with Ploni Almoni. Ploni Almoni will not redeem her, will not marry her, will not redeem the field. He's willing to do it. He is, in chapter 4, a leader among the Zakenim, the elders in the city. We're going to see his conduct with his field workers, where he tells them, don't harm her, don't do anything bad to her, take care of her. In general, just seems like a stand-up man. If you take a look at source number 1 on the sheet, Dr. Ziegler supports this. This is from her introduction to Ruth, and it's something that we talked about when we introduced the book. She felt that one of the goals of the book is to show that the Davidic dynasty comes from people of great selflessness, and Boaz, of course, is one of those. If you take a look at source number 1, Nachon shabitul ha'atzmi shel Ruth eino davar sheyahadut dereshet mikol Yehudi. It is correct. We saw this source already before in our introduction. It is correct that Ruth's self-nullification is not something that is demanded of every Jew. Ahu hechreach muchlat kishem edubar b'manhigenu, but it's a must for our leadership. Lo zu bilvad shenu mitzapim lekach b'manhigenu, and not only is it something we anticipate from our leaders, zeu gam tnai makdim lekinun melucha. It's a prerequisite for the monarchy to be established. Bli Ruth liyad ha-hageh, without Ruth at the helm, bli mishu shemesugal latet ba'ofen muchlat ubilti anochi la'acher, without someone who can give in a truly selfless way to others, hamlucha eina havtacha o chazon shel shefa eliyum misukan. The monarchy becomes something very, very dangerous, and so on. And about Ruth, but she sees it in, the excerpt I brought was about Ruth, but she sees it in Boaz as well. However, there are some problems with this read. What's the problem? What do you see as a problem with reading Boaz as all sunshine and rainbows? What challenges do we have in reading Boaz that way? Yes, Susan.
Well, I found a few. One, all this taking care of Esther, why did he put her through it? He could have right away done what he should have done as the next, well, we say Claudia Moni was the next one in line and then him. But he could have arranged with Claudia Moni. Why did she have to go through this embarrassing an uncomfortable position in the first place?
Right. So one question you have to ask is, why in the world does he put Ruth through the gleaning experience? If you take a look at source number 2 on your sheet, you see a medrash that asks exactly that question. Medrash in Vayikra Rabbah. Limdascha Torah derech eretz. The Torah taught you proper conduct. Shekshiyehe adam osa mitzvah, osa b'leiv sameach. When you do a mitzvah, do it with a happy heart. Sheilu haya Reuven yodea shakadosh baruch hu machtiv ala vayishma Reuven vayatzilehu miyadam. With the sale of Yosef, Reuven tries to save Yosef by saying, let's not kill him, let's throw him in a pit. And the plan is so that he'll be able to come back later and get him. So had Reuven realized Hashem is going to put his thoughts into the Torah, Hayatano umalicho etzel aviv, he would have picked up Yosef and brought him back to his father himself instead of saying, well, let him sit in the pit until I can get there later. Ve'ilu hayodea Boaz shakadosh baruch hu machtiv ala vayitzbot lakali, and had Boaz known that, again, Hashem was going to have this book read and he gave her parched grain, Agalim betumim haya ma'achila. He would have fed her fat calves, you know, assuming she wasn't a vegetarian. He would have given her something real, something substantive. This is pointing to Susan's question. What he does is disappointing. She pointed it out in terms of the fact that he could have offered to redeem and marry instead of, you know, it waits until chapter 3 when she makes the request. But aside from that, even just having her glean, you know, give her something of greater substance. That's one question to ask. What else could we ask? Yeah, Hannah.
I think I didn't like when he warned the guys, okay, give her the text, that's one thing, but Alti Garuba, he didn't warn them about not being mean to everyone. He said, for real, don't yell at her. Why? I thought it was a little bit of...
Right. So Hannah points to something that I want to get to after we talk about Boaz, and that is, what were the conditions of gleaning out in the field? Because Boaz's comments to the gleaners are very surprising. His comments about, you know, don't shame her and don't touch her, and it's like, what were they doing in the field? So that's something I definitely want to come back to. And in fact, is he just giving special treatment for Ruth? Or was this something broader that was not just about Ruth, but it's for people in general? I'm going to come back to that. Yes, Susan.
Can I go up further ahead when we're with Clonia Moni?
So you can go further ahead if it's still within the question of, is Boaz a good guy, or are there problems?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think once he realized and she was going to get all the land, he manipulated Ploni Amoni so that Ploni Amoni would say no. He started off, Ploni Amoni said yes, but then you have to da da da. And the way he formed it, we all knew what Ploni Amoni's answer was going to be. And it just didn't seem all nice and right to me.
So we're going to come back. All right. So we will come back to the dialogue with Ploni Amoni. There are some things that we have to note there. But we already have some questions about Boaz, and I'll add one more question. In the beginning of chapter 2, we introduced Boaz as a close relative, not just a relative, but a close relative. The way that it's worded, he's moda le'isha, and the commentators tend to explain moda as somebody who is specifically an intimate. He's somebody who's close. And if so, I don't understand why Naomi didn't turn to him in the first place. You have this rich and powerful relative in town who's got lots of fields. You're coming in broke. So, you know, aside from his obligation to redeem, like, why didn't you talk to him? So it could be simply she's ashamed, right? We talked about last week the fact that she would rather be supported by gleaning than have to go to the people who knew her when she was powerful and ask them for help. That was Malbim's comment, so it could be because of shame. But perhaps it's because she doesn't think that Boaz is going to help them. Now, most people, when they read Ruth, just go with our first approach, which is, of course Boaz is wonderful. He's got to be wonderful. But I'm going to show you that the Gemara doesn't think so. Take a look, please, on your sheet at source 3. This Gemara in Bava Basra is the same discussion that we've quoted before. So, Amar Rabba Bar Rav Huna Amar Rav, Ivtzan Ze Boaz. Rabba Bar Rav Huna quotes Rav to say, Ivtzan is Boaz. Okay, I know who Boaz is. Who's Ivtzan? Someone help me out here. What's an Ivtzan? Oh, I know. Yes. Ivtzan is one of the shoftim. He is one of the people I think of as the mini shoftim, which is not a statement about their height. It's a statement about the stories that we are told regarding them. Some of these shoftim get these very long stories. We have 3 chapters about Gideon, as an example. We get a lot of information about Avimelech. We get a lot of information about Shimshon. Devorah gets 2 chapters. What's, Ivtzan is one of those shoftim for whom we get a very bare bones description. There is, if you were to look in shoftim, you would find that you have in chapter 10, Tola and Yair, and then you have the story of Yiftach, and then after that you have in chapter 12, Ivtzan, Elon, and Avdon. Those are the 5 mini shoftim. All we are told is their location. In some cases, we get their family size, and we're told where they are buried. And Vayishpot, that they led the people. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 4, I didn't just refer you to the verses, but I actually gave you the text because I wanted you to realize just how little space we devote to Ivtzan. Take a look at source number 4, please. Vayishpot acharav es Yisrael Ivtzan mi beit lechem. After Yiftach, uprose Ivtzan from Beit Lechem, from Bethlehem. Vahilo shloshim banim u'shloshim banot. He's got 30 sons. I'm sorry, I paused in the wrong place. Vahilo shloshim banim, he has 30 sons. U'shloshim banot shilach hachutza. He had 30 daughters whom he sent outside, meaning he married them to people outside of the family. U'shloshim banot hevi lebanav min hachutz, and he brought 30 girls to marry his 30 sons. Vayishpot et Yisrael sheva shanim, and he is a shofet for 7 years. Vayamat Ivtzan vayikaver beBeit Lachem, and he died and he's buried in Beit Lachem. Now, you know there's got to be more to this story. I mean, 30 sons and 30 daughters? That takes intent. It's not like, the session this evening that I'm doing for the Nishmat conference that I mentioned last week. So my session this evening that I'm doing with Rivka Sonnenberg is family planning after the age of 35, deciding when to stop. Ifzan apparently did not have that, you know, conversation. I don't know. How do you end up with 30 sons and 30 daughters?
That means Ifzan was very old and Ruth was very young. So maybe that's why Naomi didn't approach him.
So Naomi didn't approach him because she felt he wasn't going to be a fit for Ruth, you're saying. But she could have approached him for help. Just, food. I mean, he's got fields and fields.
A lot of wives.
Yes. Presumably there's more than one wife involved here. Presumably there's a plan involved here. So when we learned Shoftim in the Thursday afternoon shiur at Alina's, we talked about this in the context of an article by Rabbi Michael Rottenberg, in which he floated the idea that this was actually a plan from Ifzan, and it fits with some of the other Shoftim in that same section in the book, the mini Shoftim. I gave you a link, I think, on the sheet, in source number 5, to a class I once taught on this, about Ifzan as the prequel to Ruth. And basically, the marriages in this story are political. And in general, Ifzan has a strategy. The system of Shoftim breaks down in the fact that the position of Shofet is not hereditary. You have someone who is a Shofet, they do whatever they do, and then there's somebody else who's a Shofet, and it was not hereditary. As a matter of fact, the Gemara in Sukkah says, each of the Shvatim had at least one Shofet. Each tribe had at least one Shofet. So you had somebody from Zebulun, and then you had somebody from Levi, and the Abarbanel tries to figure out exactly who is from which tribe to make this work. But the point is, it's all over the place. Ifzan is part of a trend that tries to change the system and to create a network so that he has these 30 sons, and he has these 30 sons-in-law, and the goal is that they'll take over after him. The only one who had a chance to be hereditary was Gideon, because the people came to Gideon and said, we want your kids to rule. And it seems like something happened there. Gideon himself said it's a bad idea, but it looks like it actually did happen, except then up stepped Abimelech, one of his sons, and killed all but one of his siblings. And so that put a stop to that plan. That's a longer story in and of itself. But the point is that that's what we have about Ifzan. How does that make him Boaz? Where does that come in that he should be Boaz? So Ralbag gives us a little bit of basis in source number 6. Ralbag, very rational as always. He says, Ulefisha Boaz nir'am me'inyano, shaya shofet Yisrael, v'hayami beit lechem. He says, first of all, Boaz is a judge in Israel. He hangs out at the gate. He bosses around the elders in chapter 4. Bosses around, sort of. He's from Beit Lechem. The only shofet we know of who is from Beit Lechem is Ifzan. So if Boaz is in the period of the shoftim, which we said in the beginning of the book, and if Boaz is himself a shofet, and if he's from Beit Lechem, the only shofet we know who is from Beit Lechem is Ifzan. Therefore, it makes sense that they're the same. This assumes that all the Shoftim are listed in the Book of Shoftim, which is a standard assumption. Not everybody agrees with it, but in general, it's a standard assumption. So therefore, he says, Amru Rabbo Seinu Zaki Ifzan Zeboaz V'Nachon Hu. So that's why the sages say it, and he says it makes sense. Parenthetically, there are actually two Beit Lechems. There's one in Zebulun, and there's one in Yehuda. So the assumption here is that this is the one that's in Yehuda. Okay. It also works because Ifzan was wealthy, right? If you look at his story with the 30 sons and the 30 daughters, that's the impression you come away with. And Boaz is, of course, wealthy with all of his fields. It's also possible. Yes, Chana.
Boaz has another son. There's one son that he didn't marry off. How can it say that
So Ruth's son will not be from from Ivtsan's kids that are listed in Shoftim. We're going to get to what happens with those kids. So it's actually, this would be number 61, so to speak. It's a good question, but wait a little bit and you'll see. Another note is that Ivtsan's name is interesting. The five mini Shoftim who we mentioned, Tola, Yair, Elon, and Avdon, those four, their names appear in the early history of the Jews, either in Bereishit chapter 46 or in Bamidbar chapter 26. However, Ivtsan's name shows up out of nowhere, which leads the commentary in Divrei HaYamim that is credited to Rashi to suggest Ivtsan is not actually his name at all. The real name is Boaz, and Ivtsan is a hint of Tsanun. Tsanun means to be cold. He is the father who was cold, and as the commentary says it there, it's Rashi in Divrei HaYamim Aleph, Perek Bet, Pasuk Yud Aleph, says that it's because he had the opportunity with Rut in chapter 3 and didn't act on it. He held himself back there. So that makes him the Av Tsanun. Okay. However you get this association, and I think Ralbag's point is really where the Gemara is coming from, what we read in Ralbag in number 6. The Gemara does not equate, or does not link Boaz and Ivtsan in a positive way. It links them in a negative way. Take a look, please, at source number 7. The rest of this Gemara on Boaz and Ivtsan. It is a hard-to-grasp Gemara. I'm going to read it in my English translation just because there's a lot of it, but you can see the Hebrew there for yourself as well. What does this teach us? This linking of Boaz and Ivtsan, what does that teach us? Like another lesson of Rabba Bar Rav Huna, he was the one who said Ivtsan is Boaz, he also said the following. He said, quoting Rav, Boaz made 120 feasts for his children, meaning wedding meals, right? Each of the sons and each of the daughters get two feasts. And they quote the pasuk that we saw in source number 4 about those 30 and 30. For each child, he made two feasts, one at his father's house and one at his father-in-law's house. At each feast, he did not invite Manoach. He said, with what will this childless mule pay me back? Who is Manoach? Sorry, what, Chana? Somebody?
Shimshon's
father, right? Remember that Manoach and his wife Hatzlal Poni do not have any children until Shimshon comes along. So he says, why should I invite Manoach to my kids' weddings? Right? The ultimate pragmatist. He can't invite me back. So I'm not interested in inviting him. We learned, gets worse, all of them died in his lifetime. All 60. It is as people say, if you birthed 60 in your lifetime, what are the 60 for you? Go have another child who is more energetic than 60. And of course that ends up being the child from Ruth. What in the world is this Gemara doing? I mean, I liked Boaz, you know, 23 minutes ago. Where did this come from? What are we talking about? So it fits once we link Ivtsan and Boaz. First of all, just in terms of Boaz himself, when we read the story in Megillat Rut, we find no children for Boaz. He has no kids helping him out in the fields. He's walking around the fields himself. This is Boaz, the shofet, is walking around the fields himself, instructing the people who are working there. More than that, though, take a look, please, in Rut, Perek Gimel Pasuk Yud, chapter 3, sentence 10. When Ruth approaches Boaz, saying that she wants him to marry her, Boaz's response, Vayomer, and he said, Berucha at Lashem biti, you, my daughter, are blessed to God, heitavt chasdeich ha'acharon min harishon. This new kindness from you is even better than your earlier kindness. In other words, he is the benefactor, right? He is the one who is helping her, in the sense that he's redeeming the field and he's marrying her and she had no protector and now she does, but that's not the way that he views it. It's her chesed to him because she is going to provide him with a family. Not only that, jump ahead to Perek Daled, chapter 4, sentence 6, and the conversation with Ploni Almoni. When Ploni Almoni does not want to marry Ruth, right? Vayomar HaGoel, this redeemer said, would-be redeemer, Lo uchal lig'ol li, I can't do that. Pen ashchit et nachalati, because it would ruin my portion. What he's talking about, we'll see, I expect, when we get to chapter 4, but what he's talking about is that he has kids. And if he marries Ruth, that's going to warp how the order of inheritance will go that he had anticipated leaving for his children. So he says, Ge'al lecha atas ge'ulasi, you do it. Why isn't it a problem for Boaz? Why won't it mess up his nachala? Because he doesn't have one. Because Boaz doesn't have other kids. So the, and one last piece in favor of that, chapter 4, sentence 11, the bracha that they give to Boaz when he marries Ruth is that she should be like Rachel and Leah, who built up the house of Israel. They built up the house of Israel. Ruth is going to build up his house. Because again, he doesn't have kids. So therefore, what the Gemara is really doing, number one, is saying that if Boaz is Eve's son, something must have happened to all of those sons and daughters. And then their conclusion is, like we find so many times in Tanakh, an idea that is extremely painful, I think, but you have to acknowledge that it's there. They assume if something happened to all 60 of those kids, it must have been a punishment. It must be that he did something wrong. That's the way the Gemara reads it. And again, I'm not into assigning guilt and assuming things about bad things that happen to people, but this is the way that the Gemara is framing it. But it leaves out one piece. Right now, all we've demonstrated is, number one, the Gemara thinks Ibtzan is Boaz. We know Ibtzan has lots of kids. Therefore, must be that something happened to all those kids, because otherwise Boaz should have had kids in Megillat Ruth, and it's very clear that he does not. But what's this business about cruelty to Manoach? And this is going to bring us back to our analysis of Boaz's personality. What in the world are you doing about having him be cruel to Manoach? Number one, they're not like close neighbors. Manoach lives in Dun, off to the west near Philistine territory, right, near Gaza. That's not next door to Beit Lechem, right? You're on the wrong end of the country. You've got Manoach is in the west, and Boaz is in the east. So that's number one. Number two, there are two shoftim between Ibtzan and Shimshon. You have 18 years in between those stories. Like, why did we feel like that had to be? So I think you could offer two points. Number one, it fits the image of Ibtzan as a pragmatist. He has 30 sons and he has 30 daughters as an attempt to try to, he has 30 sons and he has 30 daughters in an attempt to try to control the future leadership of the people. He is a pragmatist with his political marriages. He has 30 daughters who he marries off to 30 men from outside. And he has 30 sons who he marries off to 30 women from outside. The image is that there is some level of planning and control involved in these marriages. It makes him a pragmatist. Why should I invite you? What are you adding to the party? And number two, that would finally explain why Naomi will not go to Boaz for help. Because she doesn't think Boaz is going to help. Boaz is busy with his plans. That's the way that she looks at it. Rose, I see you. Just to, again, honestly, this feels a little bit like cobbling together a piece here, and a piece there to try to make all the different elements work together. I'm not sold 100% on this narrative. It's the best I can do with what we see here in the Gemara and our problem of why doesn't Naomi go to Boaz. But the pieces that do hold together are, number one, identifying him as Ibtzan I can see it. Recognizing that Itzan is childless, has 60 kids, and then Boaz is childless, you do recognize that something happened. And the Gemara's framing, and this is really the key, the Gemara's framing is that if something happened to Itzan's 60 kids, that must say that Boaz is not who we thought he was. There must be something up with Boaz. That's the way the Gemara reads that. Just to provide a happy ending for that terrible read of Boaz, because you have to. When I gave this shiur some time back, about, you know, the one that's linked on the sheet, about Ibsen as the prequel to Ruth. So someone wrote to me, they heard it online, and they sent me a message on it, and I thought what she wrote was correct. And that is that if so, then taking care of Ruth, as Boaz does in the end, is effectively his redemption. It's his tikkun. If Boaz, in the beginning of the story, is absorbed in his plans and concerned only with making sure that he gets what he wants, by the end of the story, that's not who he is. He's reaching out to take care of Ruth. And so this ends up being sort of his redemptive arc. Okay, Rose, and then Susan, and then Ricky. Sorry, Rose? I think she's frozen. Susan? You're muted.
Okay, yeah, I'm muted. My problem now, I think of Yitzchak, Mary Rivka, and the story about her age and his age. But I don't know the history of the time, but I would figure Ruth's about 20, maybe? And is it not? I know you need someone to a patron, but marrying him is just...
So...
It seems very ugly.
Okay, so Ruth is definitely not 20. In any stretch of the imagination, Ruth cannot be 20, just because she was married for 10 years to Mahlon before he died. So I'm hoping she didn't get married at the age of 10. The Medrash in Ruth Rabo or Ruth Zuta, I forget which one, says that she's 40. How old Boaz / Ibsan is depends on how many wives he had. If he produced 60 kids. She's not painted as being a child in this story. To me, 20 is a child, yes. Okay. And now Rose is back. I lost you on my screen, but I know you came back. Nope. Okay. Ricky. Oh, there's Rose. Yeah. You were going to say? You have to unmute.
From the narrative, it seems like he's trying to be king. He's an empire builder. He's gathering everybody. He wants to be the king.
Yes, that is what it looks like.
Okay.
That is what it looks like. I mean, one of the key differences between a shofet and a king is that the king's position is hereditary. The shofet's position is not. So he's trying to solve for that. That's correct. Whether it's for his own sake or for the sake of stability for the Jews is another story. Ricky.
Is there any explanation as to why there's a name change? If his name is Ibsen, then I just call him that. Where did that come from, the Boaz?
Right, so that's what I had mentioned from the commentary to Divrei HaYamim, that his name is actually Boaz, and he's called Ibsen as a reference to something that happens in this story. But do recognize that people go by multiple names in Tanakh all the time. Sometimes they're close to each other, and sometimes they're wildly different. I suspect it has to do with living in a pre-literate society in which you don't have written records that everybody is bound to. I mean, just on a very simple level, the fact that we have all the time Eliyahu, you know, and all the other ones whose names do the same thing. Granted that this is a more dramatic difference than that. My point is only to say that you weren't locked into a particular version of your name the way that now I am because I have a driver's license.
But if Will is writing this book, why doesn't he just introduce him as Ibsan and not introduce him as Boaz?
Well, I think it's the other way around, because Ibsan is a reference to his actions as Boaz. His real name is Boaz.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Boaz is the real name. in Shoftim, he's being named Ibtzan as a hint towards his actions as Boaz. The question is the other way around. Why in Shoftim didn't he get named Boaz? And I don't have a good answer. We could have just been explicit and called him Boaz and removed a lot of challenge. Although then the Gemara would have had less to do. Brona.
Yes, talking about names, why is Ruth continuously referred to as Ruth the Moabite?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's only one Ruth in this whole story.
Good. So that goes back to a point that I had made a little bit in the end of chapter 1, that she is going to be known as the Moabite all along, because it's going to bother people that she's a Moabite. We're going to see a specific application of it when the people in the fields identify her as a Moabite. But yes, this is not random. I'm sorry?
Does this mean that she hasn't converted?
No, it doesn't change the conversion. Remember, we said that if you're not supposed to marry a Moabite, that applies whether they convert or not. The problem of marrying a Moabite does not prevent conversion. The identity as a Moabite persists with conversion. If a Moabite male converts to Judaism, they're not able to marry non-Moabites.
Okay, another question. If Naomi's sons were killed because they married somebody who wasn't Jewish, why would Naomi want Ruth to go to Boaz? The same thing might happen to him.
So the assumption has to be that, and this goes back to the discussion that we had about what the sin was of the family, you know, as a whole. The assumption has to be that whatever it was that they did wrong, that caused their death, wasn't a violation of the law of marrying Moabites. And the proof for that is, as we said, that we end up quoting Shmuel, that you're allowed to marry a Moabite. What may have been wrong was that they didn't know that at that time. At that point, they don't know it's permitted. They think they're doing something prohibited. That was the Gemara Nazir that we talked about. Okay. Short note now, before we get into the big question of what's going on in the fields. This is going to introduce the discussion of what's going on in the fields. Someone asked this question last time. And I said there's material on it, so now we're getting to it. The beginning of chapter 2 sees Ruth say to Naomi, I want to go glean. Ruth says, go ahead. Naomi does not say, I'm going with you. Why doesn't Naomi go with Ruth? Easy answer is, she seems to be older at this point. That's certainly the way she frames it. Zakanti, I've already aged. Gleaning in the sun is arduous work. So the answer may simply be she's not physically capable of it at this point, and she knows it, and Ruth knows it, and there's no point in emphasizing it. What else could you suggest, though?
We talked about embarrassment.
Right. So you could suggest that the point is embarrassment. If you take a look on your sheet, I brought you the Malbim in source number 8. The Malbim writes, Hiskima lalachet lokot ka'achad ha'aniyim. She, Ruth, decided that she's going to go glean like one of the paupers. Shaloch avtza shagam chamota telechima, because she didn't want her mother-in-law to go with her. Shadai bizayon uklima achar shenoda bi'ir azot legveret va'ashira. It's already humiliating for Naomi that everybody knows that this woman who had been so powerful is now a pauper. So Ruth says, I don't want to put her through this. I don't want her to have to suffer in this way. And therefore she said, and Brona, this goes back to your point, therefore the text says, Vatomer Ruth Hamoavia. Therefore Ruth, the Moabite, said, because she's from somewhere else. Velotevo, she won't be embarrassed. And that way, she will support Naomi in a dignified way. So the way Malbim reads it is that Ruth doesn't want Naomi to come along. She says, I don't want you to have to be subject to this. I don't want you to be embarrassed. I'm going myself. And that's the point of her comment to Naomi. Moish and then Susan. Moish, go ahead.
Just a very short suggestion. There might have been a custom, and this would make sense, that you didn't have more than one person go to any one field within the city. If you had a larger family, then you'd spread them out over the city so you wouldn't look like you're hogging basically one field just to yourself, and therefore only one person from the family would go to any one field.
But then why wouldn't Naomi go to a different field?
That's another question. No, that's a good question, but this way it was easy to not ask that question, because
it's an interesting idea. Okay. Okay. We like those. Susan, go ahead, please.
Maybe this goes back to also what Naomi didn't like him. And therefore, if she went to Boaz's field, which they knew had food and was for gleaning, she would have to face him, and she didn't want to have anything at that point. Because we see, she keeps sending Ruth to him, but she's in the background. She never...
So the only problem with this is that she doesn't even tell Ruth about Boaz and his field. Ruth ends up there. Naomi doesn't send her. Yes, that doesn't really work. But one other element, this is from Dr. Ziegler in source number 9, and I don't like this idea the same way that I didn't like the idea that led to it in the first place, but I think it's important to present. I think it's an interesting view of what's going on. You remember that in chapter 1, we asked why Naomi keeps on rejecting Ruth and Orpah. And so Dr. Ziegler's suggestion was, she doesn't want them. She sees them as the cause for the death of her sons. She sees them as something embarrassing. And so she doesn't want them to come along with her. And that was her explanation for why Naomi does not react enthusiastically to Ruth's conversion speech. When Ruth says, your nation is my nation, she doesn't give her a hug. There's no embrace. There's no warmth. So her suggestion was, because she doesn't want them, and she didn't want the conversion either. You know, again, I find that difficult to fit within the story as a whole, but she sees that as fitting what's happening here as well. Take a look at source number 9. She says, "Tegubata shel Naomi nir'et chalasha emet." Naomi's response here, when Ruth says, I'm going to go glean, is weak and fuzzy, right? If you were to go back and take a look in chapter 2, in the beginning of the chapter, when Ruth says, I'm going to go to the field, I'm going to glean among the stalks, wherever I find favor in someone's eyes. And so Naomi says, L'chibiti, go, my daughter. So she says, that's kind of a weak response. U'me'ufyenet b'kitzur u'b'choser hitlahavut. He says, you see it in the terseness of it and the lack of energy in it. Lema'aseh, in practice, bidvareha k'tzarim shel Naomi anu shom'im et hadei nisyona hakodem limnoa mikaloteha leitzdaref eleha. So, in her brief words, in the brief words of Naomi, we hear the echoes of her attempt to keep her daughters-in-law from joining with her, from staying with her. Dr. Ziegler says, these are the first words we're hearing from Naomi since her attempt to convince Ruth and Orpah to stay home. The idea is that demonstrates that she's still trying to push them away. That's the point. Even as Ruth is trying to get close to her and trying to help her. So within this view, Naomi still is not happy about Ruth being there. You follow? That's the perspective. Like I said, I'm not sold. Janine. Yeah.
It doesn't sound like a loving relationship.
Yeah, you don't have to convince me. I think it's an interesting narrative. I don't think it fits. I just don't see it. So, I'm going to suggest now another view. We've seen three explanations for why Naomi doesn't go. Number one, she's already older, and gleaning is hard work. Number two, Ruth wants her not to go because Ruth wants to save her from embarrassment. Number three, she's alienated from Ruth. She doesn't want to be with Ruth. She's certainly not going. But I'd like to suggest a fourth view. And that is that gleaning was a hostile work environment. And this brings me back to what happens out there in the fields, as we've already referenced. The Torah's instructions regarding gleaning are very, very clear and repeated in the Torah. If you take a look at source number 10 on the sheet, I gave you references for where you can look it up. You can see it in Parshat Kedoshim. You can see it in Emor, last week's Parsha. You could see it again in Parshas Re'eh. The Torah talks over and over again about the importance of supporting the needy. And if you look in number 10, I just gave you bullet points for the different terms that we use for what the needy people are entitled to. There is leket. Leket means whatever it is that the workers drop. So they're entitled to it. If you're familiar with Leket Israel, excellent organization, you know that that's what it's named for. Then you have shichacha. Shichacha, like from the word lishkoach, to forget, means if the workers forget to take something, they missed it, then you get to get it. And then pe'ah, pe'ah literally is a corner, taking the corner of the field which is left at the end of the harvest. The farmer is responsible to leave some over at the end, and specifically to leave it at the edge of the field so that the needy will know where it's being left. You don't want a situation in which they're going to leave it somewhere and then they have to trail around the farmer waiting to see where this is going to be left. So it's supposed to be left at the corner of the field. The other two words that I translated there are very important in understanding the story. One is shibolim, one is omarim. Shibolim are the sheaves. Omarim, plural of omer, are bound sheaves. Shibolim are the stalks, and the omer is when it's been collected into something. And you'll see why I emphasize that in a little bit. Are we clear, though, on the gleaning? Okay, so here's my problem. Having just spent a couple of minutes walking through the different things that are supposed to be left and how many times the Torah says that you're supposed to leave it, take a look, please, at chapter 2, sentence 2, and tell me what's strange. What's strange here? Yeah. She says, I'm going to go find someone who's going to be nice to me. What do you mean be nice to you? He doesn't have a choice. This is his obligation. Leave the stuff. Why is this subject to somebody finding favor? And it gets worse. It gets worse. It's not just that. Take a look, please, at chapter 2, sentence 9. This is when Boaz is speaking to Naomi, to Ruth, excuse me. He says, right, set your eyes on the field where they are harvesting, v'halachta acharehen, go after them, halot tzivisi es hane'arim levelti nageich. I have instructed the youths that they shouldn't touch you, right, they shouldn't harass you, and for good measure, take a look at sentence 15. In sentence 15, she gets up to go glean, and Vayitzav Boaz es ne'arav le'mor, Boaz instructed his youths, saying, Gam bein ha'amarim t'lakeit, let her collect among the amarim, the bound sheaves as well, v'lo sach limuha, and do not put her to shame. Don't embarrass her. Gets better. Sentence 16. Leave stuff for her from the Tzvatim, we'll talk about that. Abandon it and she'll take it. Velo sigaru va. And don't yell at her. Again, who licensed them to yell at anybody? And finally, in sentence 22, when Ruth tells Naomi that she gleaned in the field of Boaz, so Naomi tells Ruth, oh, keep going back there, right? He's our relative. But look at sentence 22. Vatomer Naomi el Ruth kalata. Naomi says to Ruth, Tov biti, good, my daughter, kisei tzi'im na'arosav, that you should go out with his na'arot. Apparently there were women working in the fields as well, so it appears. They velo yivke'uvach b'sadeh acher, and they shouldn't be pogea. They shouldn't harm you, in some sense, in another field. You see this? Something like, what is this environment like? Why is it that she should worry about being hurt? It's interesting. Naomi only mentions this concern at the end of the chapter. Right? Where were you in sentence one when she said, I'm going to go glean? You didn't say anything then about getting hurt out in the fields. I think the answer is that in sentence one, they didn't have a choice. You didn't have good places. Now she knows there's a good place, so she's going to tell her about this. Yes, Rose.
So I just want to say two things about this narrative. A few things. It appears to me, first of all, they talk about the young lads, and we don't actually know what the age difference is. But we have to assume that the girls are significantly younger. So physically, they can outmaneuver the girls. And it appears that there is no morality in that field. In other words, they're available to the men. There isn't anybody supervising. Even the harvest was they gave old harvest. So there's nothing proper and decent and righteous about any of these fields.
So,
and that's what it speaks to, because he was so specific for this particular, the fact that he even said, let's give this girl special treatment, means that he knew that all this was going on, and he did nothing.
So,
So,
well, that's where I wanted to go. I mean, the question is, what exactly is going on? Is this really a hostile environment? I don't know about the assumption about age between the men and the women, but overall, it really does seem like this is a terrible thing to have to do, this gleaning, and this is why I said, going back to how I started this point, that may be why Naomi isn't going, because this is really not a good place to be. Susan.
First of all, in my English for 22, it uses the word molest, which is much harsher than your word, which was harm.
Well, it's the truth is that the word isn't clear. The word in Hebrew is pega, pe gimel ayin, which literally can be read as to encounter. It's, on the other hand, we talk about a pega ra, it's some kind of negative encounter, but it's really non-specific. Molest isn't a bad translation, but I'm not sure it's correct.
But doesn't this also point to the fact that Boaz is not the best of me people?
So again, this is where we want to come back to. We're not going to finish the topic this week, but that's where I want to go with this, is to understand, why is this going on in Boaz's field, and is it only Ruth he's giving special treatment to? Gita.
No, I was just saying, of course, pigua is such a bad word. I mean, is there anything, can it ever be positive?
So it's not going to be positive. I mean, it's true that pega can also mean a tefillah, can be a prayer. But that's clearly not what it is here. Don't let them daven with you. That's not what we're saying.
That's what Naomi says.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is what I want to understand. The first approach, and this is Professor Meltzer in the Dot Mikra, if you take a look at source number 12, is, yeah, the workers are human beings, and some of them are better human beings than others. That's what he says. If you take a look at source number 12 in his commentary in the Dot Mikra, v'afal pisha leket l'aniyim min ha-Torah, granted that it's a biblical right for the paupers to be able to collect the different gleanings. Mikomakom harayu kachoma tnot aniyim utztaka. It's like all gifts to the needy. It's like all tztaka. Shalawakom nos nimosab osan befanim shochakot. He said, shochakot, I should say. Not everybody gives with a smile. That's just a reality. You know, there are people who, someone comes to their door and they invite them in and offer them food. I'm not pre-COVID, but you give them, you know, a sense of dignity. And then there are other people for whom it's enough of a challenge to write a check. They, you know, people have different personalities. And so he says, unfortunately, the answer really may be that there was hostility there. I would support the view of Professor Meltzer. I see you, Moish. I see you, Janine. I would support that view by pointing out that we have various periods in Tanakh in which people are not giving the needy the things that they're supposed to be giving, right? If you remember those who were there when we learned Ezra and Nehemiah, so Nehemiah has a whole discussion about how they were oppressing the needy in a variety of ways. I think it was Perek Hay. We know that in Tzidkiyahu's day, they're not freeing the Eved Ivri in Shemitah the way that they're supposed to. Not in Shemitah, after his 6 years. The way that they are supposed to. The reality is that, that Jews didn't always do what Jews were supposed to do, and this may be an example of it. And again, keep in mind, we're talking about the period of the Shoftim. Right? Add it to the list of things that people were doing wrong in those days. We have a long list already, so this is part of that. That's definitely a way to take it. Moish and then Janine. You're muted.
Okay. You're gonna love this. Okay?
I love it when it starts that way. Go ahead.
Ani is only superficially about poverty. It's about status. Walk down the Yonge Street and how many people are you and other people going to even look at the people who are on the street with their heads up?
Right.
There's no status. Forget about, that they're going to pinch them or all that stuff. They look at them like dirt. And they know they're dirt because they know that they're poor. That's the only reason they're there.
So you're agreeing?
Sorry?
So you're agreeing?
I agree with everything you say in advance. Afterwards, it's a different story.
Whatever you say. Janine, go ahead. Yes.
It's not just not being nice to them. It's hitting them or assaulting, but there's something
right. Right. And in my notes, I actually had split it into two different things, which I'm sort of mixing here, but you're right. That really Professor Meltzer is just saying you want to find a more generous one. The second way to look at it is that it's a really hostile environment. There's a Mishnah in Peah, which points out that the way Peah is supposed to work is that the owner of the field simply leaves it, and then the needy people come take whatever they want. That's all. And if all of the aniyim, all the needy people say, we want you as the owner to distribute it, to split it up, then it can be done. However, says the Mishnah, and we're going to see it in a second, if there are 99 gleaners who say, we want the owner of the field to divide it up, and one of the gleaners says, no, just leave it and we'll take whatever we can get, then that's what you do. You leave it for them to take whatever they can get. You don't distribute it. You don't split it up. The fear is that if you empower the owner of the field to split it up, they start favoring the ones they know. You want to avoid that. But take a look, please, at what the Malbim does with that. In source number 13. In the interest of time, I'm going to read out my English translation. She said, I will collect, leket, was the verb used, among the stalks. Meaning she would only take leket, for which the needy are not as demanding, for there are many fields, and each one collects in a separate field. Sort of like what Moshe was suggesting before. That when it comes to leket, there wasn't such a fight for it. As opposed to Peah, where each grabs from the other. For the law is that if 99 paupers, this is what I quoted you from the Mishnah, say to have the owner distribute it, and one says to have the paupers just take, we listen to the one who says to take. So that becomes a big fight, the Peah. So Ruth says, I'm not getting involved in Peah. I'm just taking leket. If so, the paupers would take by force, and if she wanted to take, then those of bitter spirit would harm her, meaning from the needy. Also, regarding leket, she said, after the one in whose eyes I find favor, that if I see that the owner of the field looks at me with a stingy eye, I will not collect there until I see that I have found favor, and I will not suffer shame from the harvesters or the other paupers. So, number one, it's a hostile environment because of the struggle to glean and the way that it pitted people against each other. But also it's about Beit Lechem. And this takes me back to the point about the era of the Shoftim. what we know about Beit Lechem is best summed up by the two events that mention Beit Lechem at the end of the book. The story of first Pesel Micha, and then the story of Pilegesh Begiv'ah. In the story of Pesel Micha, this fellow Micha sets up his statue, and he hires a Levi to go run the service for his quasi-idol, whatever that was. We discussed it when we learned Shoftim. The point is that Levi was from Beit Lechem. Number one. Number two, the last story, that horrific story which begins with the rape and murder of a concubine and then spirals from there into civil war, she is from, again, Beit Lechem. And that whole story is a commentary on the concubine system and the lack of morality involved in it, among other things in that story. The point is that Beit Lechem was not a good place. That's what I'm trying to show you during that period of time, which makes sense with source number 14. Ha, we're going to wrap up a source sheet. When does that happen? Take a look at number 14. So I see your hand, Ricky, but I'm already at 2:31. So I'm going to hold off. I just want to show you quickly, and you know what? I'm not going to race with it. We're going to come back to it next time. It'll be okay. So we're going to pick up with that source next time. So what we got today, and then Ricky, I'll take your question or comment after that. What we got today is two different views of Boaz. What I think of as the mainstream view, the way people normally look at him, he's righteous and wonderful, but it leaves us some questions about how he treated Ruth, as well as why Naomi didn't reach out. And our answer in the end is that there is an alternative view, the Gemara in Bava Basra, which says he's not so wonderful at this stage in the story, and perhaps his redemption comes through what he does for Ruth. We also know that Naomi doesn't go with Ruth. We gave multiple explanations, including the possibility that it's a hostile environment in the fields, which is borne out by the text that we just showed. We have more to see about that, God willing, next time. And then hopefully for the week before Shavuot, we'll wrap up chapter 2 and we'll see some elements of chapter 3, hopefully the Eshet Chaya line about Ruth, and that'll take us into Shavuot. Thank you very much. Okay, Ricky, what was your comment?
I was wondering why all this, these details about the I lost the word, the gleaming is it to show Boaz as or to show Ruth how brave she is to go into these circumstances, or how bad things were during Shoftim, and which makes her look even more positive and even more righteous.
I mean, the story has many lessons.
Details. There must be a reason why Shmuel included them, because they don't necessarily really, it's a little bit too many details. When I write something, you have to know how much to give to each section that you want to write. This is a little bit more, I think.
So to me, what you're seeing here is detail, which number one is important for the whole story, because it feeds into introducing who Boaz is. It shows us information about Ruth's character. It's an integral part of the story. It also, along the way, is an opportunity for Tanakh to reiterate the importance of these mitzvot, which Tanakh doesn't lose an opportunity to do. Many places in Tanakh, it talks about the importance of supporting the needy. In this case, you're supporting the ancestor of the Davidic dynasty. So I think it's also there to teach that.
So it's all these reasons why this is important.
Yeah, I think so. Okay. Thank you very much, everyone. Be well. See you next week, I hope.
Bye.
I'm sorry?